Good evening. Is Trump's love affair with North Korea's leader showing strains? More on the Mueller report from a veteran document chaser? And are there corrupt officers in NYPD's vice squad? With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI Evening News for Friday, April 19, 2019. Architects and construction workers have now stabilized the damaged structure of Notre Dame Cathedral 4 days after a fast-spreading fire ravaged the iconic Paris building, and firefighters were leaving the site Friday night. As Catholic worshippers carried out the Way of the Cross ritual near the cathedral to mark Good Friday, French President Emmanuel Macron met with officials from the United Nations cultural agency UNESCO, who have offered their technical expertise to help with the reconstruction. Earlier, the cathedral's rector said a computer glitch may have been behind the rapidly spreading blaze that devastated the 850-year-old architectural masterpiece. He didn't elaborate on the exact nature of the glitch. And a Peruvian judge has ordered that former President Pedro Pablo Kuczynski be jailed for up to 3 years as authorities investigate his alleged involvement in a corruption case. Last week, a judge had ordered Kuczynski's detention for 10 days as he investigates some $800,000 in previously undisclosed payments from Brazilian construction giant Odebrecht more than a decade ago. Kuczynski resigned last year as opposition lawmakers sought his impeachment. Peru's former president, Alan Garcia, committed suicide earlier this week as he was about to be arrested in a corruption probe that's been engulfing South America. And Secretary of State Mike Pompeo answered questions from reporters today during a meeting with top Japanese diplomats. He responded to North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's call for his replacement in negotiations with the U.S. to eliminate North Korea's nuclear arsenal.
Nothing's changed. We're continuing to work to negotiate. I'm still in charge of the team. President Trump's obviously in charge of the overall effort. But it'll be my team, Special Representative Biegun, will continue to lead the U.S. efforts to achieve what Chairman Kim committed to do back in June of last year, which was to denuclearize. As I've said before, he's made that commitment to President Trump multiple times. He's made it to me personally half a dozen times. And I'm convinced we still have a real opportunity to achieve that outcome. And our diplomatic team will continue to remain in the lead.
Christine Ahn is executive director of Women Cross DMZ, a global movement of women organizing to end the Korean War. Since the ceasefire ended the Korean War in 1953, the U.S. has been still technically in a state of war with the country. Ahn says there has been a shift in U.S. policy towards North Korea that began when hardliner John Bolton joined the Trump administration.
We don't know what they tested. We've seen a very insignificant response from the acting Secretary of Defense. And what we've seen is North Korea make pretty clear that while Kim Jong-un is open to having another summit with Donald Trump, unless there is a shift in the administration's position on demanding complete denuclearization before any progress towards improving relations or the lifting of sanctions, that North Korea is not going to return to the table. And so we know that Kim Jong-un has given the end-of-year timeline for there to be some kind of shift in the U.S. position, but we don't know what that means. Are they going to return back to testing missiles or nuclear weapons? We don't know what that is, but clearly the North Korean position is they're not willing to go along with the U.S. demands for unilateral disarmament.
Pompeo responded to what were said to be criticisms, personal criticisms by Kim Jong-un, that he was personally obstructing the talks.
This isn't new. North Korea said last year, last summer, they called him, they said his gangster-like way of negotiations wasn't working for them. And evident that Pompeo has shifted more towards the Bolton line, the Libyan model. You got to disclose, you got to transfer all your nuclear weapons, and then we will lift some sanctions or we will engage you. And we clearly know what the outcome of Gaddafi was. North Korea's frustration with Pompeo was that leading up to the summit in Hanoi, there were clearly things on the table that were seemingly kind of a done deal. So that included an end of war declaration, that included opening up liaison offices. I guess it was getting down to the brass tacks of which sanctions the U.S. was willing to lift. And by many indicators, some experts that have had close communication with the administration, was that the inter-Korean economic cooperation was, there are sanctions right now that are blocking progress on inter-Korean cooperation. Pompeo had gone to North Korea in October, in the fall, in the winter, kind of a lot of meetings in Pyongyang. And so I think their frustration is he had agreed to these concessions or these steps towards improving the relations between North Korea and the U.S. And so that was clearly one of the things that they had felt they had come to agreement on. And so for now, Pompeo to be making these public statements that North Korea agreed to denuclearize, and we hope it's sooner than the end of the year, that just sounds absurd. North Korea agreed to do it, but it was conditional upon these other things. If you look at the Singapore Declaration, their very first thing was transforming the relationship towards improving relations between the two countries, and denuclearization was outlined as agreed to in the Panmunjom Declaration between North and South Korea. But North Korea is not going to, it's just that expectation is such a failed and broken model. And what we see instead of actually making progress towards improving relations, we just see the U.S. kind of retreating back to its broken strategy, which is to try to pass more sanctions against North Korea.
What does China have in all of this? I've heard stories that China has is not supportive of some of these U.S. Overtures to North Korea. Is that true or not?
We have to see that the bigger picture behind the conflict between the U.S. and North Korea is China, right? And just as the Cold War and the Korean War was not just a war that was fought between North and South Korea, but it was basically a proxy Cold War where really the U.S. and China were major aggressors in the conflict. And so China doesn't want a U.S.-occupied Korea along its border. The militarization of the Korean Peninsula by the U.S., which included, for example, the installment of the THAAD missile defense system in Songju, that is clearly a sign of greater provocation against China because it's a satellite system that is used to surveil China. So I think that China obviously has a say in the Security Council sanctions, which they were a party to passing. But clearly, the broader geopolitics will have an impact on progress on the Korean Peninsula. So my hope is that the two Koreas continue on its path towards improving relations, hopefully signing a peace agreement between the two countries, which would send a clear signal to both the U.S. and China that the two Koreas will remain non-aligned in the growing standoff between the U.S. and China.
Anything you'd like to add?
Trump wants a deal. He sees a more pragmatic approach in dealing with North Korea. He says he has a good relationship with Kim Jong-un, but clearly his own cabinet, Bolton, Pompeo, want to continue the broken policy of maximum pressure. And so that's why, as Americans and as citizens of this country, we have a tool to send a message to North Korea and also to our key ally in the region, South Korea, that Americans stand with the Korean people, and we want to end the oldest conflict between the United States and North Korea.
Christine Ahn is Executive Director of Women Cross DMZ, a global movement of women organizing to end the Korean War. Meanwhile, in Washington, White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders tried to do damage control on her credibility Friday, insisting she hadn't intentionally misled the American public about FBI Director James Comey's firing. That despite telling the special counsel her claim that countless agents had lost confidence in him was not founded on anything. Sanders, who told special counsel Robert Mueller that her comment during a White House press briefing in May 2017 had been a slip of the tongue, made in the heat of the moment, claimed in a series of television interviews that the sentiment behind her words, that many rank-and-file FBI agents had lost confidence in Comey and contacted the White House to say so, remained true. And Democrats have been coming down hard on Attorney General William Barr since he released a redacted report on Thursday. Attorney and former Judge Bill Blum says Barr lied when he spoke to the media.
Attorney General William Barr has crossed the line from spinning the nature of the Mueller report to outright lying about it. It is not true, as Barr said at his press conference this morning, that the Mueller team found no evidence of collusion. That's just simply wrong. The Mueller report states explicitly that a failure to find that a crime was committed, and the crime here, the report clarifies, is conspiracy, not the misnomer collusion, does not mean that there was no evidence of the crime. It only means that the evidence in the estimation of Mueller's team was insufficient to prove a crime of conspiracy, which means a proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And the same holds true for obstruction. The report indicates that Mueller didn't charge the president with an obstruction crime because of the Justice Department's longstanding position that a sitting president cannot be charged with a crime. The report, however, stresses, and this is quite outrageous, that the president cannot be exonerated of obstruction on the basis of the factual findings. Now, I'm still going through this report, and they also include in the report four appendixes, including Trump's answers to written interrogatories, which were posed to him last fall and answered in November. They are highly, highly misleading. I think the president is in deep trouble now, and I think William Barr's reputation has forever been destroyed by this report.
Attorney and former Judge Bill Blum, his latest article, Five Critical Takeaways from the Mueller Report, is available at truthdig.com. The Mueller Report follows a trail blazed by the special prosecutors who have investigated Nixon, Reagan, Clinton, and now Trump. These past reports show conniving and dissembling by presidents mostly out to cover up their political and foreign policy activities. But John Prado, senior fellow at the National Security Archive, says Trump has broken the mold. He's out to protect himself.
In the case of Ronald Reagan, his lack of transparency was policy-related. He had objectives. He had not that much concrete knowledge of how to get there. So he basically commissioned individual entrepreneurs, policy entrepreneurs, to get what he wanted and gave them a free hand to do what they needed to do. In Nixon's case, I think that his lack of transparency was personally related, personally developed, and personally aimed at his enemies. In Trump's case, I think it's similar to that, but it's sort of the reverse. He's not personally after people so much as he is personally for himself. So anybody who gets in his way then is targeted. But notice how they may be targeted today and not tomorrow, and then again the day after that. I think that relates to his fundamental narcissism as opposed to his policy direction or orientation.
From your perspective at the National Security Archive, what is this? What does this mean for national security from your point of view?
From the standpoint of the records that come to the American people, the ability to document where we have been, you know, the Mueller report actually is a great benefit because here was somebody who had the authority to establish and had the authority to question people to find out things that actually happened. But if you look at the modus operandi of the administration, the things that typically constitute America's record of itself and its role in domestic and world affairs, those things are being atrophied in this administration. You've got tweets instead of policy reviews and brisk declarations at a rare press conference in place of daily meetings with the press, of individuals appearing and disappearing and handing over official government.
Was the Mueller report a sign of the success of the special prosecutor laws and the powers of Congress to get information from presidents? Is this proving to be successful, that these laws are doing the job they were supposed to do?
That's a good question. I'm not sure I can answer it. But if you look at the Mueller report in the context of other reports of the same kind, i.e. the Iran-Contra report, the Starr report, and the Watergate reports, there are structural similarities in all of them. If you look at the Mueller report itself and the pattern of the redactions, it appears to me that the pattern of redactions in the Mueller report is that redactions were applied to those parts of the text that basically constitute the executive summary and the recommendations of the report, not the things that Mr. Barr was talking about, you know, the necessity for taking out.
We used to say edited.
Censored,
right. Now, these censored documents, these redacted documents, the pattern shows that he doesn't want people to know about the recommendations that were made by the special prosecutor. Is that in line with what happened in the reports that came out of Reagan and Nixon White Houses?
No. In the reports from Reagan and Nixon, the censorship was applied to national security information for the most part, and in certain instances, information that was politically sensitive that the administration didn't want anybody to know. I think in the Mueller report, your executive summary basically is the summary of your volume because you assume that nobody's going to read past the introduction. So if a big pile, a big chunk of the censorship is applied there, what you're really saying is what's being censored is the meat of the report. And that censorship applies to what Barr said in his press conference and what he purported the report to contain in the two letters that he wrote prior to that. So my conjecture, and so far this is just a conjecture, is that the secrecy was applied to the Mueller report to protect William Barr's misrepresentations.
And ultimately, who's that protecting?
Ultimately, it protects Mr. Trump.
From what? What do you think it's protecting him from? Something different than Nixon and Reagan, not stuff that they did regarding the work of the CIA and the NSA and all these other agencies, but something about him personally.
The problem here is that while there are, while our structural elements in the story are similar, these reports, what's changed is the topography of American politics. So Mr. Trump is counting on none of the things in this report touching him, no matter how bad they are. Nevertheless, the way that the redactions have been done and the way that Mr. Barr has represented the report still favors Mr. Trump because it's the best thing available, if you want to put it that way, to protect his link with his political supporters. If they were, you know, if they became disgusted with Mr. Trump, then he's in trouble.
I see.
And the regular political machinery, this is what I mean about the topography, the ability to impeach a president is not in the equation here, I don't think, because of the political attitude of the Republican side and because of an artificiality, this idea that you can't indict a sitting president.
John Prados is senior fellow at the National Security Archive. And in local news, a group of elected officials are demanding that the Department of Investigation look into allegations that NYPD vice cops are assaulting sex workers. The NYPD vice squad is a traditional hotbed of corruption, began a letter to the Department of Investigation and NYPD's Inspector General dated April 5th and signed by State Senator Jessica Ramos, City Councilman Richie Torres, and State Assembly members Don Quart and Ron Kim. A supervising attorney for the Legal Aid Society's Exploitation Intervention Project is Lee Latimer. She says her clients, mostly arrested for prostitution, say some cops have been taking sexual advantage.
My project represents legal aid clients that get arrested on prostitution offenses, and we represent the vast majority of people that are arrested in New York City for prostitution offenses. So we have kind of, maybe the luxury is the wrong word, but we have been observing what these arrests look like for the past 6 years. And there are undercover officers who are regularly involved in these arrests. And we talk to our clients about what their experiences are before and during their arrests. And we get kind of regular complaints about certain undercover officers. I'm not going to say all of them, but there are certain bad actors who we see regular complaints about, and we do welcome an investigation into how these vice teams are run. And in particular, we would like to know, you know, we'd like some transparency about what the guidelines are for undercover operations. We have no idea what types of things undercovers are allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do.
What is a vice team? What do they do?
In terms of what we see on prostitution arrests, vice teams are one or two undercovers and a backup team, and the purpose of the backup team is to go in and make arrests. So what we see is undercovers in a variety of ways making quote-unquote dates with women who they believe are engaged in prostitution. And their goal is to get the person to make an agreement to have some type of sexual contact for a fee. And if the person does, the backup team comes in and makes the arrest.
Do they wear like a wire and things like that, like a drug case?
We don't really know. I think sometimes they do wear wires. We have never been provided with any type of recording that's happened during a vice arrest.
How do they make these dates?
In a variety of ways. They used to do it a lot online before Backpage was closed down. They used to just go online and look for ads and call the person whose ad was posted. They sometimes go to locations where there's street prostitution and approach people and attempt to have a conversation. Sometimes we hear reports from our clients that they were just, you know, walking down the street and a car pulled up to them and try to engage them in a conversation. Sometimes they pretend to be cab drivers. There's a lot of different scenarios that we hear about.
The bad apples, the one you're referring to, what do they do that's different from the good apples?
They are touching our clients inappropriately, what we think is inappropriately. As I said, there's no transparency about what is supposed to happen, but when our clients find out that they're police officers, they feel like they've been taken advantage of and violated. They allow themselves to be touched in a sexual way. We've had clients complain that they were asked to get undressed, get in the shower, a variety of things.
Are they supposed to have sex with the people that they're trying to arrest?
I don't believe they're allowed to have sex, no. And I would certainly hope that they're not allowed to have sexual contact. I mean, we do know that one officer was investigated for just that. We don't know what the end result of his internal prosecution was, but we don't believe that he is, well, we know he's not working in vice any longer, but we don't know whether he's still on the force or not.
In your mind, in the mind of the attorneys and of your clients, that these officers seem to be having inappropriate contact with these women when they arrest them or at the time of their arrest.
And, you know, having said that, we've had clients that have complained to officers after their arrest, and the response has been they're allowed to do that, they're undercover.
What do you think? What do you want to have done? What do you want to know? What's the purpose of talking to me?
So what we would like to know is what those guidelines are, so that we can protect clients. It's obviously after the fact, but so that we can make appropriate complaints to the NYPD or the Inspector General's office to say that this particular officer is crossing the line and behaving inappropriately.
Have you approached the police or the mayor's office and gotten a response on your concerns?
We've been in meetings with the police and have asked to get access to the guidelines, and they've said that they will not provide that.
Why not?
They don't say. I can speculate that want people knowing what the guidelines are for kind of a similar reason with the undercover. I really feel for the women who are in this situation because they feel as though they've been violated, but they're they're being prosecuted, and they feel like their voices and their stories won't be taken seriously.
Lee Latimer is a supervising attorney for the Legal Aid Society Exploitation Intervention Project. And finally, potheads have for decades celebrated their love of marijuana on April 20th, but the once counterculture celebration that was all about getting stoned now is so mainstream corporate America is starting to embrace it. No, Hallmark doesn't have a card to mark 420, but many other businesses inside and outside the multi-billion-dollar cannabis industry are using April 20th or 420 to roll out marketing and social media messaging aimed at connecting with consumers, driving the booming market. On Saturday, Lyft is offering a $4.20 credit on a single ride in Colorado and in select cities in the U.S. and Canada. Carl's Jr. Is using a Denver restaurant to market a hamburger infused with CBD, a non-intoxicating molecule found in cannabis, and many believe is beneficial to their health. On 420 last year, Totino's, a maker of frozen pizza snacks, tweeted an image of a microwave in an oven with the message, "To be blunt, pizza rolls are better when baked." And that's some of the news for Friday, April 19th, 2019. The news was engineered by Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for joining us.